working quite a while, but it's still a work in progress. So you might ask me questions that I won't be able to answer, and that's perfectly fine because I want to learn from you. It also determines how I prepared the talk that it's work in progress. So instead of dumping a lot of calculation on each of my slides to show you how cool I am, I wanted to make everything simple. So if you go out and think this was actually trivial, then I actually reached my goal. So that's good. It has also one more feature, but how I built up my talk. Since you will see that I collected and put together ideas from both inflation and its currently best elaborated alternative, the aparatic cosmology. Therefore, I will start with introducing them a bit. Not so much a bit, just as much that you can understand my talk and how it relates to these earlier cosmologies. And since this is a non-inflationary cosmology, so it's an alternative cosmology, I want to start with telling you why I'm not working on inflation. Some people think that people always have the same reason not to work on the standard cosmology, and these are basically the reason what Paul tells us always. I want to oppose that. I think actually that everybody who works on an alternative cosmology has his or her own reason, and since there are not much of us, I think actually it's interesting for you to hear what my personal reasons are to work on alternative cosmology. And I can tell you that I think I'm one of the people who argues mostly with Paul, so I hope that you will get the impression I'm not having his views on many of the things. So, I oppose that I probably won't have the views of Neil on these things either, but I want to have my own views, because otherwise I would be just imitating other people. And I think actually all of you should be having your own views on things, not just because other people say that. But that was just so... Okay, good. That's okay. That's fine by me. So, why anamorphic and why non-inflation, why non-aquariotic cosmology? So first of all, I assume that you know some things about inflation. And I also assume that you know that everybody, including Alan Guth and Andre Linda, agrees about the fact that inflation is not perfect. Now, how you interpret problems and if you make them to a success, that's your understanding of problems, I think that inflation has some serious problems. And I really very quickly, because this won't be the main part of my talk, this is just the motivation of my talk, and the motivation for why I'm working on the model I'm working on. Therefore, I really just want to very quickly go through three major objections to inflationary cosmology. The first one is, I think, the oldest one. This has been pointed out first by Roger Penrose, then later by Neil and collaborator Gary Gibbons, and most recently by Lascia Bereziani and Mark Trodden at UPenn, that the inflationary cosmology doesn't do its job. It doesn't do its job in the sense that it was introduced to solve the Big Bang initial conditions problems, make it plausible why we start in a state that within standard Big Bang theory seems to be implausible. It doesn't do it. In fact, it makes the initial conditions problem in the sense worse, and this is what the different authors pointed out in different ways, that inflation requires more fine-tuned initial conditions. It requires initial conditions such that starting inflation by one measure on the other becomes more unlikely than starting standard Big Bang cosmology. I just want to point out one argument, because Neil is sitting here and can criticize me. The others are not here. If I recall him wrong, the others don't have a chance. So most simply speaking, I think his argument was that if the question was, what is the probability? Is this possible to start the universe with potential energy dominance? And the method that they applied was more sophisticated than how I will say it. They applied statistical mechanics to show that actually if you extrapolate backwards in time, what you put is packed is that you, if you forwards in time expand, you backwards in time contract. That means that while your potential energy is becoming subdominant, your kinetic energy grows crazily. That means when you start the universe, you should dispack instead of sitting on some potential energy plateau, the field at rest, You should assume that the field is going on crazy with a very large kinetic energy, which is the worst possible option for inflation. Is it fair? Okay, thank you. Okay, so this is one problem. And I think this is a serious enough problem that you should already start thinking about alternatives unless you can solve this problem. If you give me 5 minutes, I'll show you what doesn't have this problem by the same argument. Actually, Paul and Neil. Okay. So Paul and Neil has worked out. I'll show you why it doesn't work in the ekbiotic case. So why they don't have the same problem, but exactly evade this problem. If you give me one slide. Okay. Thank you. But it was a very good question in the sense that there are already alternatives that don't have this problem. Okay. The second problem is. That was pointed out first by Paul, then later by Vilenkin, and hugely popularized, as we know, by some other people on the West Coast, that inflation generically implies eternal inflation. I will get back to this point later, therefore I don't want to explain you why it is the case, because it will be important for my model just as well. Let's just state that this is bad for a theory if you want to make predictions. Given that you believe in the multiverse. Now, I said I want to say something that is not how Paul, for example, interprets the theory. So I think there is a worse interpretation of this multiverse problem. I think you can interpret the theory in a way that we just somehow don't understand the fact that we cannot stop inflation, the fact that it produces us some nonsensical things, maybe tells us that we don't understand how to put quantum field theory in a quirk background. So maybe the whole thing that we so much love about inflation is not exactly what we should be doing. Maybe we misunderstand how we marry quantum field theory with gravity when you assume across space-time. So maybe the problem is more serious than just solving the measure problem. And that's, again, just by itself a good reason, I think, to think about alternative, again, unless you can solve this problem. And the third problem is something that I think everybody agrees on. Maybe it's not the strongest problem, but given the two problems, I think it should be something that you watch out for. This is a problem I have been pointed out together with Paul and Avi Loeb from Harvard shortly after the first Planck results in 2013 came out. The fact that if you take the simplest textbook models of inflation, the monomial models that everybody sees given a book by, for example, Mukhanov, that is, I think, the best standard book still, he will tell you about m squared phi squared lambda phi fourth. Now, these models are very strongly disfavored by data. 2 years ago, it was only lambda phi fourth, which was very strongly disfavored. But this year's results, Planck 2015, actually showed us that we cannot even say anymore m squared phi squared is in a good shape. It's in a bad shape. And it's, again, important. These are not controversial issues in the sense that these are features of inflation. Everybody agrees about them. The question is just what you do about them, if you celebrate them, if you want to solve them, or if you say they are unsolvable, and therefore you work on alternatives. And there are two people in the audience who actually already worked on alternatives. And skipping this step would be not very fair and also not smart, since I will be using also their ideas. In my model, so I want to say that all these three problems are evaded in the ekbiotic cosmology. I think it's also fair to say that the ekbiotic cosmology is also a work in progress, but this doesn't have the same problems. And since I don't assume that everybody knows what ekbiotic cosmology is, therefore I want to tell you a few words about it. And again, this is a very important argument what I will give you, even though it's simple, because I will use the same kind of reasoning for why to have an anamorphic cosmology. So if you look at the first Friedmann equation, where H is a normal Hubble parameter given by the time derivative of the scale factor A over the scale factor itself, then we can read off how the different energy components in the universe contribute to the total energy density given by 3h squared. The first component, rho matter over a to the cube, is our matter component. It scales like a cube, 1 over a cube. The next one is radiation, as we all know. It scales like 1 over a to the fourth. Now, you might not see this that often. Of course, you can include into the Friedmann equation You don't know the simplest deviation from the Friedman equation, an isotropy and curvature. The curvature term almost everybody knows, because this is what you see when you start to work on inflation or start to learn about inflation. That goes like a 1 over a to the square, and k and sigma square are also here just constant, as are rho m and rho r. And sigma square parameterizes the anisotropy contribution, which goes like 1 over a to the 6th. Now, why is it important? It's important because in a contracting universe, I should say an abiotic theory is a contracting theory, assuming that the Big Bang wasn't a beginning, but the bounce, and the bounce was preceded by a phase of contraction, where this A is shrinking. So the contraction is characterized by the fact that your A is shrinking, the time derivative of A dot, is negative, so that your H is negative. Again, compared to inflation, in inflation A is growing, so A dot is positive and H is positive. Okay, so what does ekpyrosis do to solve a problem that is given if I don't add anything to the theory? The problem is the following. If you shrink, if the scale factor is shrinking, then you see that a term, which I call anisotropy, and which is the anisotropy contribution, sigma square over a to the 6th very rapidly dominates the energy density, right? Because all the other components grow much, much slower. So you see curvature grows like 1 over a square. Everything grows because a is shrinking. But this guy, the anisotropy that you never even hear of, grows very fast. So what you want to do is find some component in your theory, which is usually represented by a scalar field, that gets to dominate the anisotropy. Then you create a homogeneous, isotropic, and flat universe, because you don't have here a flatness problem. Now, and this is how actually the idea of ekpyrotic cosmology goes. Introduce a scalar field or a perfect fluid-like element. You can have, this is the interesting thing, is you can have both pictures. You don't necessarily need a field picture. You can imagine it just like a perfect fluid with a certain equation of state, whichever you wish. Epsilon is a parametrization of the equation of state, which is in most commonly denoted by the pressure of this fluid or scalar field, or the energy density of this fluid. I will use the parametrization of epsilon, since it simply tells you the ratio between kinetic energy and total energy density. So the trick is, as you see in a contracting universe, make epsilon bigger than 3, and you have 1. I should also mention here that some people like to introduce inflation this way. Inflation, as originally motivated, would be the idea where A is growing, so that you only have a curvature problem, and that's the reason why your epsilon should get smaller than 1. So that you solve the curvature problem. However, I don't think this is a fair representation of inflation. It was the original motivation. But since we know that it creates the multiverse, it doesn't solve the fatness problem. And since we know that it has the initial conditions problem, just by having this equation, it never gets to this equation, in fact. Okay? So by not having the right initial conditions, you can never validly approximate your conditions at the beginning as a closely Friedman-Robertson-Walker metric. Or even if you prepare it, you know that the multiverse spoils it such that you can have any kinds of curvatures. Inflation doesn't predict it. So it's true in inflationary theory, this equation. It just doesn't represent the theory fairly. But let's get back to ekpyrosis, because I promised Kurt to explain why it doesn't have the initial conditions problem. The same type of that inflation has in the language of the paper that Neil and Gary Gibbons have written up. So here, what we want to have is, maybe I can draw. So I should mention, if you have a field picture for ekpyrosis, I don't want to get much into this theory, because this is also not the main part of my talk. So if you have your potential energy in ekpyrosis, then what you have is, in inflation, you want to have a flat positive potential. And you are sitting on the flat plateau while you are inflating. In ekpyrosis, you start with a dark energy density, and you have a negative potential. So what you want to have is so the field rolls downhill, and the negative potential makes it possible. So if we want to write out epsilon as 3 times the kinetic energy over the kinetic energy plus your potential energy, you see as soon as you make it negative, you can have a very large epsilon, which is much bigger than 3, that solves your anisotropy problem, and then any other problem as well. But the question is it likely, if I end up here with huge kinetic energy contracting, to start on the flat plateau almost sitting? And the answer is yes, by the same argument as it was no in inflation. Because if you reverse contraction, then you get exactly what inflation does with your energy densities. If you reverse contraction, you go to expand. And in expansion, what drops fastest is your kinetic energy. So as you expand more and more, you necessarily end up at rest on top of the plateau. So this is the reason why the very same argument doesn't apply to a contracting universe than as it applies to the inflationary universe.
What criteria are we supposed to use to say likely?
Oh, scaling argument. So if this is a statistical mechanical measure, but a simple scaling argument, we don't even use a measure. So it is classical physics, so you really use the fact that the kinetic energy goes like 1 upon a squared, gradient energy goes like, or curvature like 1 upon a to the 6th, yeah, sorry. 1 upon a squared, and the potential usually goes like a log or is nearly constant, or a log. You don't even need a measure for this. It's a very simplistic argument. This is very, it's much elaborated in papers. I just wanted to, so the most intuitive thing, if you reverse contraction, you end up at rest expanding. But if you reverse expansion, you end up contracting at high kinetic energy. We can get back to this, but let me get to my point because it is really just the motivation. But it's an important point. So the two other things, it has no multiverse. Yeah, why doesn't it have multiverse? So the multiverse problem arises due to the fact that rare fluctuations push the field uphill in inflation. That means that you keep inflating. That means that the rare fluctuations, due to the expansion of the background, end up creating more volume than the fluctuations that you would need, than the more typical fluctuation, or the fluctuation you assume to be more typical that you would need to give you your universe that you would want to be typical. So more and more volume gets created of the wrong kind. And the question is, does it get created if you have a contracting universe? What do rare fluctuations do there? Now, rare fluctuations only delay the contraction, right? So what it means is that the rare patches contract longer. What does it mean? They reach the bounds later. What does that mean? They start to expand later. So those that started to expand later will be smaller. And by the simple argument, you just don't get the problem that the volume that was created later takes over. So you can just use the same measure as you would have used, the same measure as you would have used without the rare fluctuations. Typical remains typical, while inflation typical becomes increasingly unlikely.
Assumes volume is a good measure. I thought volume measures problems.
Only if you have a multiverse. Volume is a good measure if you don't have a multiverse.
But you're arguing that volume is one of the reasons why inflation is.
Yeah, so what is inflation about? Just very quickly, inflation is about giving you good kind of volume. And if the theory can, but it's supposed to give you really a lot of good volume, gives you a lot of really bad volume, then one way to do is, okay, volume measure is bad. Let's see if we can get something better. We try really hard. We get really complicated, it's still not better. We get more complicated, we still not get better. And then we say, yeah, because the volume measure is bad. Or you look at this theory and say, okay, I want to get the right kind of volume. Gives me the right kind of volume. The not right kind of volume either collapses to a black hole or has less volume. And I have no reason to give up the volume measure. So that would be my answer. But we can talk about this later. And this is a paper that...
That's still a multiverse.
Yes?
I think there's no multiverse, so...
Yeah.
So you have a multiverse in this. You just said you either from black hole, you suffer from something like that.
I don't have I don't have a multiverse with a measure problem. I can have many patches, but I can quantify my patches. I have many uniform patches. It's not a problem if I have, I wouldn't have a problem with a theory that has infinitely many patches of the same kind. That's not a multiverse problem. Multiverse problem is a problem because you cannot put any measure on the space of that, so you cannot quantify predictions, observations.
Then you wouldn't worry about having infinite probability.
Right.
But the problem with the multiverse is not at all statistically homogeneous.
I guess there is an, I said this, there is a distortion that when you go through the bounds, you might form a black hole or something that's not very, very nice. But
you don't even have to go through the bounds to make a black hole. A star makes a black hole. What are you concerned about that?
Well, it's a Hubble size black hole. So. So in this Phoenix universe idea that you and John Luke have.
Okay, so that drives me actually away from my motivation, because the Phoenix idea that you mentioned is against the paper that we just put out, in the sense that a Phoenix idea makes use of the fact that there are versions of the ekpyrotic model that require fine-tuned initial conditions.
Okay.
And we just showed, actually, if the archive moderators will be nice enough to put up, decide which category of paper belongs to and let it out. So actually, we submitted a paper. I would have hoped it's out today. It's now on hold because they don't know where to put an art theory paper on bouncing universes. So if they do that, then you will see that there are versions of the theory, which we have already written about earlier, that don't require fine-tuned initial conditions, that can be attractive solutions, and even more, they are in very good agreement with the observations, with current observations, because this is also a family of theories that during the ekpyrotic phase doesn't generate non-Gaussianity. So the models that require fine-tuned initial conditions also give you order 10 non-Gaussianities, which these models give you approximately the same kind of non-Gaussianity as single-field inflation without the multiverse. So this is actually a paper that you might want to take a look if it gets out. Okay, so that was the motivation. And then so that there remains something why I should be doing now, something else. We shouldn't stop here, the seminar, and everybody goes and works on the missing bounds or the missing full-blown bounds idea. I think what's really important is to figure if there are other alternatives as well. It's really important, because if there is one, there are many. I think this is, and because, why not? Because it's fun. So, actually, this is my reason. I want to have fun, and I also want to contribute something. Okay, so the second part of my talk is, and this should be really the main part, I want to introduce what I've been working on, but really in the simplest way as possible. And I want that you recognize that a lot of what I've been just talking about, like inflation, like ekpyrosis, will appear here. And then you have to tell me, oh, that it looks like inflation. Or you will have to tell me, but it looks like ekpyrosis. And I will say, yes, you are right. So this is how it should be going. Okay. So first of all, what I will be talking about will be a scalar tensor theory. A scalar tensor theory assumes a slight modification to Einstein gravity in the sense that it is described by the following action. So here, just a short explanation of my notation. For the metric determinant, I use G, by the metric is given by G mu nu. M Planck is the effective reduced Planck mass in the Einstein theory of gravity is just square root of 1 over square. So M Planck is in the Einstein gravity 1 over square root of 8 pi G Newton. While R is my Ritchie scalar. D mu phi square is simply the kinetic energy. And I add to this, as usually you add it in a scalar tensor theory, a kinetic coupling. And I have a potential. It's a single field theory. My scalar field, which I also call the anamorphic field, as I explain later why anamorphic, is called phi. And really important in scalar tensor theories is that you are not supposed to forget about the matter contribution to the action. Because in scalar tensor theories, the gravitational and field part doesn't tell you everything about the behavior of your physical background. Okay, so this is actually known stuff. This was just a reminder. And I introduce one more simplification. It's not necessary for my theory. It's not necessary for scalar tensor theories, but it's very good for introductions to assume that your matter is simply dust. So it is described by some simple, very, very simplistic action, which is given by the integral over M, which is a mass of any kind of test particle. We assume here uniform test particles and the line element ds. I will also assume for most of the time when I don't talk about the flatness and anisotropy problems, the Friedman-Robertson-Volkow metric with the minus plus plus convention. And now we come to the essence of the whole thing. If you get this, which is very simple, because it's just a definition of two parameters, then that was the essence what I wanted to tell you. Okay, but I will be, yes?
This is the action for one particle?
No. So it can be the action from one particle, and it can be the action for any particle. So yes?
It's a sum of it.
Is there a sum of
it? Yes, it's an integral, yeah.
No, but have you got more than one particle in the universe?
You can get more particles, yeah, but it's still represented.
Where is the particle?
Okay, so the point what I will be doing is I will represent it as dust. So it's not a realistic theory.
No, but it's homogeneous.
Yeah, I know what you are talking about. So we won't have a team you knew, right?
Yeah.
So I won't work with that. I only need this. So I only need this SM to define it so I can define transformations between mu in one frame, mu in other frame. So it's not I don't put in a, I don't qualify it. I could qualify it as a field. I can qualify it as a team you knew. Then it wouldn't look like this.
But you just put a sum
yes,
of
yes, yes, exactly.
Can I ask you one more question about
yes.
the particle action?
Yes.
So if you're in Einstein frame,
yes.
shouldn't you have a coupling defined?
Yeah, that I will get to this.
Okay.
This is the only reason why I introduced this. So it might not be the best way how I said it. It's actually, thank you. This is the first time I talk about this, so it might not be the best way to put it below it, but that's why I introduced this kind of action. So maybe that is the best way to say what I mean by my SM in this form. But what I simply mean is a test particle, an action for one particle, and if I sum over it, as Kurt said, it's probably in the most simplistic model, okay. Okay, so the two invariants that are important will be called, and won't be completely unknown quantities, theta PL and theta M. And they are, we have already talked a bit about Einstein frames, and there is Jordan frame, and there are string frames, and there are other kinds of frames. So and that's where the name comes. They are frame invariants because whatever frame you take, so for example, this action, given that a reduced Planck mass, effective reduced Planck mass is phi dependent, is and the SM, whatever this is represented, the action describing the particles or the sum of the S particles is phi independent, that is the so-called Jordan frame representation. The representation that you all know, where your SM is phi dependent, and I will get to this on the next slide. And the reduced Planck mass is a constant given by 1 over 8 pi g Newton. That's the so-called Einstein frame. But there is string frame and there are other frames. And it's no matter what frame you take, these quantities will be in all frames the same. Namely, and what do they mean? So H means here, you can take your Hubble parameter, which is in any frame, given to you by the ratio of the A dot in the frame over A. Given that Hubble parameter, theta PL describes the behavior of the background relative to the Planck mass. And why do I have to have a dot here? Because in general, my Planck mass will be phi or time dependent. Now, of course, you also see, as we said in Einstein frame, by definition, or M Planck is constant, therefore, and if we work in MPS units, so Planck units, then we know that in Einstein frame, what you should get is that your theta PL is your Einstein frame Hubble parameter. Yes?
Is this, are these covariance covariance, so long as you're in FRW, or is there a generalization of this to more covariance?
I'm sure there can be generalizations. As I said to you, I have been so far working on this that I can also introduce more thetas with respect to more masses. So I really just want to have the simplest example of this one. But I'm not sure what kind of generalizations will be. I'm very confident there are many generalizations if you need some. Okay, and again, it's important. That's why I mentioned you a particle action will be important, or test an action for a single text particle is actually enough for this. The important thing is if you assume uniform coupling of all particles to your field, then you can, and that's why you can have, if you don't assume uniform coupling, you can have many thetas. If you assume uniform coupling, then you can quantify the behavior of your physical background or whatever with respect to your test particles in terms of this theta m, since this measures what you do relative to the particles. For example, and this is what we usually do when we talk about expansion of the background or contraction of the background. In Einstein gravity, again, these would be the same y. Because m Planck is constant and you have no coupling in a simple Einstein theory, so the two would be the same and both would be the Einstein frame Hubble parameter. As soon as you have a scalar tensor theory, your theta PL is still the Einstein frame Hubble parameter. However, theta m, where is the mass non-varying, is a Jordan frame. So theta m would be the Jordan frame Hubble parameter. So this is really simple, but it's important. And also important that even though I have been switching between frames, you in fact don't have to go out of one frame to tell what is your theta m in one frame, theta pl in one frame. You can just use this definition and apply it. And it's good if you believe me, but I actually want to show you how it works in Jordan and Einstein frames. We know that the Jordan frame metric can be by a Y transformation transferred into Einstein frame. Namely, if you take the Jordan, you call it, you can call it whatever you want, but the simplest way is to call it G mu nu. So you call the Jordan frame metric G mu nu. Then you can introduce a function. This is a function of the single scalar field that is governing your theory. I will call it F. F will play a special role, but let's just call it F. And call the Einstein frame metric the metric that is given to you by f of phi times g mu nu, where g mu nu is the Jordan frame metric. Then your scale factor from the Jordan frame transforms just by, of course, f is the square of the line element, therefore it transforms like aj, where aj is the Jordan frame scale factor, times square root of f. And now we also learn what f means. F is the gravitational coupling to the Jordan frame Ricci scalar in the action. So the effective Planck mass in the Jordan frame is given to you by square root of F, while in the Einstein frame, if you did your job correctly, it must be one, working in Planck units again. So test particle mass, again, just using the action that we've been talking about, can also be transformed by just substituting for the line element and taking into account that by definition, in the Jordan frame, your mass is phi independent. Just like Matt said, we get 90 Einstein frame a mass that is phi dependent by virtue of the division by square root of f. Okay, and now I should show you why you never get have to go out of a frame to say what your theta Planck is. So what we would expect, even though if we start in Jordan frame, we should, if we make the transformation correctly, at the end we should get the result that the theta PL in Jordan frame is just a Jordan frame representation of the Einstein frame Hubble parameter. Okay? And this is what happens. So if you recall the definition, you first divide by the reduced Planck mass, then you substitute for your Hubble parameter in the Jordan frame, and you take the variation of your reduced Planck mass into account. You see, this can be summarized as a log. And you also see that it's really important to be careful, because also our time derivative transforms. So the square root of f is really important, because that transforms your Jordan frame time derivative into an Einstein frame time derivative, so that you really see the theta PL is nothing but the Jordan frame representation of the Einstein frame Hubble parameter, just as expected. And of course, because I introduced it as divided by MPL, I can add this since it's one. So just if you define it as non-one, then you will get it automatically. And the same we can do with the theta M. We just want to see that in the Einstein frame, the theta m is the Einstein frame representation of the Jordan frame Hubble parameter divided by the Jordan frame reduced Planck mass. And this is again the same exercise. You substitute, you take the log, take the time, the transformation, light transformation of the time derivative into account, and you see that it's indeed the case. Okay, so that was just to convince you that these are really frame-independent parameters. What comes next is what I told you I want to remind you in the talk, always that there are other cosmological models. So these parameters, of course, not just apply to what I want to be talking about, they also apply to inflation and pyrosis. But in an interesting way, because they will give the motivation to what I want to do now. So if we have what we said is Einstein frame, actually it would be enough to look just the field and gravitational part of the action, because the matter part is always phi independent in the Einstein frame, where your reduced Planck mass is also phi independent. So you would expect that, and in fact, this is the case, that your theta m and the theta pl are equal in any frame, and they are always the Einstein frame bubble parameters. And this is also the definition of these theories. So in inflation, as we just said, theta m times the reduced Planck mass in any frame should be just the representation of the Einstein frame Hubble parameter and be positive because you expand. And that means also, again, not because the theta pl is positive, but because here the theta m is theta pl and is greater than zero, that your background expands because your relative to your text particle masses, you are expanding. So in a pyrosis, it is the opposite. What you do is you contract, therefore, the Einstein frame Hubble parameter, which is, again, also theta m and theta pl, because, again, you are in Einstein gravity, is, and this is how the theory is defined. You can define it in, of course, in scalar tensor theory representations, but you still have to conform these ideas. Otherwise, it's a different theory. And you contract. Now, I said many bad things about inflation. I should say something nice about it, too. Maybe not, but I do it anyway. Okay, so the Einstein frame, in the Einstein frame, that is where we usually do the semi-classical quantization of perturbations, and that's how we compute, actually, the curvature perturbations that create us the anisotropies in the microwave background. Now, this theta pl actually plays a pretty big role there, because just by looking at it, we know actually why we like, why some people like inflation, and we know why in pyrosis you, in, by some measures, have to work harder. Because due to the fact that in the Einstein frame, your theta pl is again He, so the Einstein frame Hubble parameter, which is positive and nearly constant, this leads to the fact, if you write down the action for your curvature perturbations, or calculate from this the epsilon, that your curvature perturbations grow. So you get what you want, and this is what people tend to say to you today, this is what we like about inflation. I don't care about initial conditions problem, I don't care about the multiverse, what I get are the perturbations, and that's what I can measure, and therefore I'm done. So, I mean, I don't think this is, as I said, it's a solid argument, but let's say that the part that HE is positive is a nice feature of inflation. If we, and in the sense that theta pl is positive. If we could keep it without the other parts, then we wouldn't be sad. And this is, by the way, why some people say, oh, we don't like the ekpyrotic cosmology. Because when you do the same exercise there, then what you get is the result is that in single field ekpyrosis, you cannot create curvature perturbations. Because your curvature perturbations due to the contraction decay. So what you do, in fact, and why people still work on these models is you create first two-field, you consider two-field or multi-field models, you create isocurvature perturbations and convert them during the bounce into curvature perturbations. But this is the reason why some people say, oh, that's complicated. I think it's not, because the multiverse is more complicated, but if we can do better, it's not bad. What do I want to do now? So what do I like about this? What would be the ideal world and the world where I have to do least to make some progress? Not final progress, but some progress, or with the prospect that I could learn something. Well, nice would be if I could marry the ekpyrotic background with the inflationary perturbation theory. Why? Because in inflation, what I don't like, that this pore, the pore that my curvature perturbations not decay, makes my theory to a nightmare, since the background amplifies these perturbations. And it not just amplifies the perturbations in the right way, they amplifies them in a way that they take over, so that my semi-classical calculation breaks down, and I'm in a quantum mess when you either assume there is a multiverse out there, or you don't know what to do. So why not to try it in the following way? Let's assume that I can make a theory where I have a background that behaves like the ekpyrotic background, in the sense that my theta PL is negative. So my HJ in the Jordan frame is negative, and my background therefore contracts. And why not to make a theory where, unlike in ekpyrosis, my theta PL is positive instead of being negative. Then, if I'm lucky, and if I don't get into big roadblocks, and that's what I hope to convince you of, then I can have single field curvature perturbations produced by a single field theory that don't decay and don't produce the multiverse. Now, it's a lot to promise, so therefore I try to show you that it's not a lot, that it actually can work. And if anybody finds a good argument why it doesn't work, I'm also thankful, because I want to learn. Okay, yes?
So the definitions, I mean, these thetas, yes? Really think of them as the expansion of a congruence of time-like geodesics in two frames. So I mean, like the way you define theta, you know, H is the expansion of time-like geodesics in the
Which H?
Well, I mean, if we're talking about not a scalar tensor theory, but just GR, then H would be the expansion.
Yeah, but I'm not sure if it... Okay, so I must say I haven't thought about this, and without thinking about it, I don't want to give a bad answer. So I think it's a good question. I want to think about it and get back to you. Sorry? But I don't want to say yes to a question that I haven't thought about. So I want to think about it, and we can chat about it, and I want to say what I think. No, I only give answers when I'm fairly confident of them. Okay.
Paper, I think, with Justin Corey, where
yes?
They argued that inflation and ekpyrosis are the only possible ways of getting a scale invariant spectrum from a single field over something long.
Assuming I'm in gravity. Yes, it's always the factor. So I don't prove anything inside Einstein gravity. I say my main point is we have to depart.
If I just go to the frame in which the mass is independent, yeah. It is just
No, because the matter part is neglected then. So then this is the point of scalar tensor theory, is that it's not enough to look at the Einstein frame representation of the field and gravitational part. You have to look at the matter part. Yes, but not Einstein gravity. So we have to look at the paper, but I'm pretty sure that they assume no coupling the matter, the scalar field to the matter in Einstein frame. That's what they, because...
Do you have another field in addition to phi in your model?
No, but you could represent, for example, what Neil asked, the particles by fields. You could add a field. I haven't done this. It is what I said, it's work in progress. This is what the first thing, and I also want to show you the simplest version of the model. So, okay. It's not much more, it's really... okay, so actually this is really the most important feature of the theory, and I only have really two more really important slides, and afterwards just the fun how to play around with these things. So if you can hold through. It's also important, it's a contracting theory. So you cannot get away without the bounds, okay? So it's really important. However, as you see, since it's not necessary to have an Einstein frame bounds, since your theta PL is already positive, what we need for standard Big Bang cosmology, but is necessary that in any model you will have to bounce your Jordan frame Hubble parameter. And I work in the momentum models where I actually want to bounce both. But it's not necessary, and it's an interesting feature of the theory that you can have bounds in one frame and you don't have to have bounces in other frames. Which might teach us something about bounces, what is good for something else. I don't know, but I like it. And where the name comes from. So the name comes from the following fact. I'm not sure if here are artists, so I'm not an artist and I'm really bad at art history, but I know this. So there are pictures which are called anamorphic art. And why are they called, why do they belong into the category of anamorphic art? Well, because if you look at a picture from a certain perspective, it tells you something. This picture tells you that you see mountains, and between the mountains there is a lake, and there is a shipwreck in the lake, and two people are looking at the lake. And there is somehow the sun in the sky. But if you put a cylindric mirror there where the sun is in the sky, then the picture looks quite differently. Then this is the face, what you thought is a not so pretty or pretty landscape, is now the face of Jules Verne. So, and this is called anamorphic art. Looking at things from different perspectives, they appear you differently. So looking at the anamorphic cosmology from one way, it looks an awful lot like inflation. Looking from another way, it looks an awful lot like pyrosis. And then at the end you say, and which one is it? I think which question you ask. And this is a bit like, probably if you ask, is it a wave or is it a particle? Well, it depends on which question you ask. But hopefully if you ask the questions where, for example, inflation has the problems, then you can look at the model such that it doesn't have the problems, the anamorphic model. And this is, in fact, the last part of my talk, what I want to show you. Before that, though, I want to explain you, and I have to explain you before, how it looks, what I do. Because we know scalar tensor theories. Actually, you should know, actually, Higgs inflation is a scalar tensor theory. So why is it not my model? It's not my model, by the way, because that theta m is also positive.
Yeah. So in both the ectoparodic and the imaginary case, the matter becomes irrelevant very quickly because it's dominated by the other components.
But it doesn't mean that you cannot use it as a ruler. So it's still your measure. It just it doesn't dominate your energy. For example, we are here today. We are not overly important for the large scale structure of the universe, but it doesn't mean that we cannot make measurements. Right? Because we also are dominated now by dark energy.
I would think that anything you predict at late times should be independent of that, however you couple it to matter.
No, because you cannot measure things. You can only measure. So if you make it independent of the matter, then you can only make statements about how things behave with respect to Planck mass. You cannot make the statement when your background is compared to rulers expanding or contracting. So that's the point. But just let me make this quantification, because I think it's justified to ask, okay, what about Higgs inflation? That's scalar tensor theory. Why is it not anamorphic? Why does it have the multiverse problem? Why is your thing different? And in fact, it's different for the following reason. In Higgs inflation, your theta PL is positive, but also your theta M is positive. And this positivity is due to the kinetic coupling. What you can do is, you can have a positive coupling to gravity in scalar tensor theory, and you can have a negative kinetic coupling. Now you should all get nervous, really nervous about this, because negative kinetic coupling is usually a ghost. So I let you believe it for the next second that it's a ghost, and then afterwards I show you that it's not. Okay, so I could introduce a negative kinetic coupling that makes my theta M definitely, it can be shown negative, and I work with a positive potential. However, it's also known that it's not a ghost. So what this kinetic coupling does is it lets the field in a positive potential in the Jordan frame representation, phi is again my anamorphic field, Vg is my Jordan frame potential, roll upward in Jordan frame. Of course, you can go into Einstein frame, your field will be rolling upward. In the moment, I do everything in Jordan frame, and if you want, we can, or you can do it afterwards in Einstein frame. Doesn't change anything about the theory due to the fact that the main things that I'm talking about are frame invariant. So why don't we have a ghost? It is a well-known fact also that if your kinetic energy, so if you transform your kinetic, your theory, your action, your Jordan frame, Lagrangian density here, but if you transform the full action with the minus g, square root of it, with the density metric, then you get a new kinetic coupling in front of your kinetic term. Now, this is your total kinetic energy. And as long as it's positive, you are not in a danger of having a ghost. This is, I think, also an important lesson to see that in the Jordan frame, this is not your kinetic energy is the only one that carries the not your kinetic coupling is the only term that carries kinetic energy. Your gravitational sector also carries kinetic energy. So it's a really nice way of looking at scalar tensor theories from this point of view. Okay, so setting up the action, now I can derive the Friedmann equations for a metric with curvature and isotropy. Of course, in the Jordan frame, it looks differently. Again, I use the Jordan frame because I want to show you in what sense it's ekpyrotic. Because you remember in Jordan frame, the Hubble parameter is negative. So we expect in Jordan frame, it looks a bit like ekpyrotic. If you went into Einstein frame, the same argument would show you why it looks inflationary. So in some sense.
But is that, so in Einstein frames, it's going to be always inflationary? Is that?
It should look like, but not always, because the theta n is negative in Einstein frame too. I'm just talking about the gravitational part of the action, gravitational and field part
so
of the action.
So the Einstein frame, we're talking about a ghost with like an Einstein gravity ghost?
No, no. So, okay. Let's imagine the Einstein frame Lagrangian. We made the metric transformation.
Yes.
Then higher, first of all, you have a new Ricci scalar, okay? So, okay, let's take the Lagrangian density times this, because otherwise it's not valid, the transformation. So you transform the metric determinant, and you also transformed your Ricci scalar. Here, this is a constant. Again, Einstein frame Ricci scalar, not a Jordan. And then what you get here is... Yeah, this is important. So what in the Einstein frame, your kinetic energy is given to these guys.
But the Hubble with respect to this metric,
yes.
Is positive or negative?
No, so again, no, that's not changing because that's not metric dependent, that's why it's frame independent. This stays positive and this stays negative. Nothing changes because otherwise I would be in inflation.
But theta PL is Hubble in Einstein metric.
Yes. But, yes, it's Hubble and Einstein frame, yes. Theta M is Hubble and Jordan frame. That's why the closest you get in Einstein frame is what looks like inflation, the closest you get in Jordan frame looks like ekpyrosis. And if you ask me, is it by accident, I would say, no, that is actually, if you understood me, then that's what I wanted. Okay? So what's happening here? So I showed you, I argued that the usual picture is, that's what also Kirtner emphasized, usual strategy is try to make the field energy density dominate over the dangerous guys. And if you recall in ekpyrosis, what I told you, as soon as you are contracting, like here your A is shrinking, you should be afraid of the anisotropy term. However, you see that the anisotropy term here is hit by the gravitational coupling. And this gravitational coupling actually assists you in killing your anisotropy from the Jordan frame point of view. So if you go the good old way and assign the total energy density of the field or the right on the right-hand side, epsilon effective, which will be your Jordan frame effective equation of state. So again, not the usual epsilon that you talk about in Einstein frame, but if you do this game, because this is how the other people did it, so it is, I think, nice to understand it, what this theory does, then you will want that this effective equation of state is bigger than some number. It's big because the AJ is shrinking, so you want that this term grows fastest, and then you have to now decide what is dangerous, the curvature or, as usual, the anisotropy. The curvature is simply going as 1 upon h to the square. And what we know is that we can factorize the anisotropy as follows. Of course, the 6 comes front, and we can factorize the f going like beta. And from the fact that from this condition that your theta PL is positive, we know that this is either constant or growing, the f square over aj to the 6. And therefore, we know that this beta must be bigger than 2. So that where we arrive is that we smooth and flatten when our effective epsilon in Jordan frame is greater than 1. Now, if you noticed, in ekpyrosis, it was greater than 3. So it, in this sense, different than ekpyrosis, but in the sense like ekpyrosis, that it, again, you in Jordan frame have a large effective epsilon. OK? So this is how you smooth. And the perturbations, now you won't be surprised, hopefully, because this is how I set up the theory. The perturbation should look like as if you were in good no multiverse inflationary theory, and the no multiverse part is something I owe you. So if you take the perturb metric, where you introduce zeta as the perturbations of the scale factor, which we consider as a curvature perturbation, then this is just a well-known procedure. You can derive the action. You can do it in Jordan frame. You can do it in Einstein frame. You know, by the way, if you look at the perturb metric, that it's frame invariant, because everything gets hit by a square, so that the ds gets hit by an f and all the other factors too, that the zeta, in the sense frame where the zeta is frame invariant, I introduce conformal time in the action, which is also frame invariant. So I get that, and then I have the action, and what I arrive at is that I have here a prefactor, which, and this is a prefactor that determines if you can have scale invariant zeta or curvature perturbations or not. This prefactor tells me that I'm not at all like ekpyrosis. In ekpyrosis, you would only have an a squared. And because this a is shrinking, therefore you are in trouble because your curvature, that indicates that your curvature perturbations decay. However, here, just like in the anisotropy, in the case of anisotropy, you again get hit by an f. And that means that instead of aj squared shrinking, you have an aj squared f being constant or growing. And that indicates you that you can have your perturbations as you intended to have it. Okay, but yes? Yes, like one upon x squared, that's what I get usually. In the constant equation of state model, I get exactly that. Yes, it has a, so actually the worked out model in our case, we also fit observations, goes like this. And this is how it should, one upon eta squared, where eta squared is conformal time. Yes, exactly, that's what I wanted to get. Yeah. So, yes, good. And now the question is, because this is a big deal. So the question is, am I able to buy this trick of introducing my theta m being negative and marrying it with the theta pr being positive, am I able to state that I don't produce this eternal runaway behavior, that I don't have one way or the other the multiverse, or the multiverse with a measure problem? And so here's how my best argument goes. I want to remind you what I did already, but once more, that in the inflationary slow raw picture, so it's really important to notice that you don't need complicated potentials, even in the simplest and potentials, but most importantly in the plateau potentials that are currently so favored because they are fitting the data so well, you necessarily get eternal inflation in the multiverse, just due to the fact that your potential is flat. Actually, the flatness that you want also kills you, because if you imagine that you don't actually have a field, but a field distribution, which is, because we don't know better, we imagine it as the classical field moving downhill, that's why the negative sign, and a quantum addition contribution to the field, which I marked here by small Greek delta phi dot square and the square root of it. And the classical field is just delta phi CL. So the problem arises in inflation when your Lille bump, what you would think is only a Lille perturbation, overrides a classical downward fluctuation, and the quantum uphill fluctuation pulls the field upwards and continues to inflate, or makes you continue to inflate. And this occurs exactly then when your d rho over rho hits approximately 1, or when your v to the 3/2 over v prime is approximately 1. And you know that if v prime, if your potential is very flat, your v prime is very close to 0, that means that you, the flatter your potential is, the more you are on the plateau, the more you have eternal inflation. So the question is, what happens in my case, in our case? OK, so what really is the problem here is the sine of theta m. The question is, can quantum fluctuations make me reverse the sine of theta m that is irreversibly? Because once I get that positive, once I get my theta m positive due to these guys that spoil the inflationary picture, then I'm also in trouble. Once I get them positive and stay positive. Now, just again to remind you, in Ekpyrus's, they are lucky because they have this always negative. No quantum fluctuations can make that theta m negative because this is also that theta pl, which is negative. In our case, most quantum fluctuations we are keep because we have a large delta phi dot. So delta phi, sorry, large downward fluctuations and small upward fluctuations in most cases. We'll keep this theta m negative. So there it looks like the ekpyrotic case that your volume just delayed, so the contraction is just delayed, and you reach the bounds later. However, and in this sense, it's different than ekpyrosis. You don't get away that easily. Because you can have an upward fluctuation that pushes your field into the other direction. So far I haven't said it, but I assume that our field goes into the positive direction, so that phi dot is positive. It goes downhill in Einstein frame. It should look like that. So what if an upward fluctuation pushes your field such that theta m quicker turns sines? Then you would think you start to inflate, right? Because your Einstein frame equation of state is inflationary, and now your theta m is also positive. And in fact, you start to inflate. But the question is how long? And this can be quantified. So in inflation, you don't just start to inflate, you stay there because the inflationary solution is an attractor solution. But here, the inflating solution is a very strong repeller solution. So what you get is that your solution wants to quickly go back, and quickly means within less than one Hubble time, so you produce less than one E-fold, get back to your negative theta m. So what you create is an extremely short inflationary phase, which produces you very little E-folds that then outproduced by the contracting phase.
So if I describe this Einstein frame, your claim is just by coupling, having a matter field that's coupled to my inputon, that alone will suppress this argument.
But, and if the other constraints are also fulfilled, that you have a negative theta m, which I told you, I want to give you the simplest pictures. It puts, of course, of constraints on your coupling function and your potential. But yes, I claim that in the simplest language, coupling and setting up the theta pr positive, theta m negative being an attractor solution quickly makes the inflationary multiverse solution a repeller in Einstein frame. And gets you back there where your Jordan frame theta m is negative. That's what I claim, yes.
So did you specify a potential yet?
In this talk, not in my paper, yes. The simplest potential you can take in Jordan frame is a power or an exponential. So you can play around with the...
What is it in the Einstein frame?
You can have an Einstein frame also exponential, but of course then that's what I come next. You can worry about the end then, how you end. So you have a positive potential, so it's non-ekpyrotic positive potential, and then you have to construct your potential such that it fits the observation, and also that it comes to an end. And I must mention something, of course, which I didn't mention. Your F and the K at the end freeze out so that you match the standard Big Bang conditions. So today, of course, in order to match the data, at the end of the anamorphic phase, you have an F, which is your 8 pi g Newton, and you have a K, which is positive and flipped sign. And I really don't have time, so I just show you a picture, which is cute. So what I've shown you is really just the smoothing phase. It's really just the smoothing phase that gives you the homogeneous and isotropic background and the perturbations. But we really have a job to do. We have to embed this model. So this is a complicated picture. I tell you just two words about it. But you have to embed this picture into a picture that gives you at the end your standard Big Bang cosmology. And you can do it in a very simple way that you only implement the theta m bounds, or you can make it cyclic when you start with a metastable dark energy dominated phase. That vacuum decays, you get done. So this is not part of the anamorphic phase. I just want to start contraction. Why do I want to start contraction? Because, again, two things, and this is really just the end, so this is just so for fun. I want to solve not just the multiverse problem, I want to solve, in some sense, the initial conditions problem. So I want that I set my initial conditions dynamically. What do I have to do if I start today? I need to raise the energy density, and I have to switch the sign of my theta m. And that raising the energy density requires, this is just one model. I'm very confident there are nicer models. This is the first model. It requires that I raise the energy density and that I raise by contraction, since if you introduce a negative diff into the potential, the field starts to roll uphill. That means you can get up the potential, which is the energy density that you need for the right amplitude of your perturbations. And the second thing is, but at some point, now you're here, all your Hubble parameters are, you are still in Einstein frame, both of your Hubble parameters are negative, and this is really just something that not really related to the smoothing phase at all. You have to switch the sign of your Einstein frame Hubble parameter, and that's what we do, and I found that part very nice, but it comes out in a separate paper in a Galilean-like wave and want to create a null energy violating bounce that doesn't have the problems that earlier bounces had, so this is stable. And this is how I set my initial conditions for the field. Maybe it looks complicated. It is also not nice in the sense that this is a working model. I want to show here many things that are possible. And I don't really want to close my talk with this, oh, you have to do all these things to make the model work. But my message would be is, I think there are some ideas that are worth exploring. I think that there is, what I like about it, a way, maybe a different way than the ekpyrotic case, or if it works, it's a different way, to solve the multiverse problem. And this is worth thinking about. There are, I think, many ways how that model can go. What I haven't solved, of course, is I was complaining, because I want to be fair, I was complaining about inflation that has many parameters. Now, my model doesn't have less parameters, so I'm not that far, and that is fair to say. I was complaining about ekpyros is that they don't have a full-blown theory of the bounce. Well, I also need bounces, and I cannot do yet better. So it is more like, I think it's a different idea, and I think we learn a lot of things, and I myself am curious where it leads, and I hope I'm here the next almost 2 months, so I hope that I can chat with many of you about it, and I'm really happy about questions during the lunch and later. Thank you.
So I guess my comment is the fact that it's called anamorphic has nothing to do with the fact that your name is Anna.
So that I had to explain later, it was, so I'm working, of course, I mentioned it earlier, so I'm working on this project in very close collaboration with Paul, and this was his idea. So I'm not guilty, and I didn't really want to take it, but I got this joke quite often already, so.
Okay.
But blame him.
Okay. So the second thing is, it seems that you're just doing inflation, and if I just do Einstein frame, then it's just inflation.
Parts of it, yes, and parts of it.
So one part of it is nothing.
So, two parts of it. Your theta m is negative.
No, but then if I just stick to Einstein frame,
then why is it not like Pyrrhus if you just stick to Jordan frame?
Well, because the process as was originally defined wasn't an Einstein graph.
But you can always define it in scalar tensor theory.
No, but then, so then...
That's not a fair game, right? Because you say, in order to show that it's inflation, I don't want you to go to Jordan frame. And I say, okay, but if I go to Jordan frame, then you don't, and I say ekpyrosis because it's Jordan frame. So no, let's go back again, Einstein frame. So the
Thing
yeah, that's what I'm saying.
There's 2 degrees of freedom. There's a tensor degree of freedom.
Yeah. But he doesn't want to consider the theta m, so then.
And they're conservatively at time, so we should be able to say something like the amplitude of the relative to the amplitude of these perturbations at late time is different in this.
So you mean observational consequences?
Yeah.
Okay. So this is a really important point. So in the moment, and I told you, this is not something that I feel ready. In the moment, the best thing I can do is matching observations, but I don't have a signature that is different from, that is adds to current observations. However, there are two things. So inflation, of course, predicts the multiverse. If I convince you, I don't predict the multiverse. So that's an observational distinction.
You don't have multiverse in your model.
Well, I was trying to convince you now.
Well, I mean,
her claim is that in Einstein frame you can guess coupled to matter and have nothing.
Yeah.
I guess the coupling must be huge.
But that's a change. Yeah. I mean, it says that you just have a field and gravity. There's a scalar field and gravity. There's nothing.
And matter. I have.
But matter doesn't contribute. Well, let's see.
Contributes in the sense of deciding whether you're expanding or contracting compared to a ruler. You want to ask, in the multiverse, you want to ask, do I make large regions compared to my ruler that are large compared to the region I'm seeing?
Okay,
I'm actually secretly using the ruler when I do it. It's just that when you talk about in normal inflation, we don't bother to mention the ruler.
The ruler is why you use the volume measure in Jordan frame rather than.
Yeah, but you can use it because your theta is indistinguishable from theta PR. So, yeah.
Okay, so
the statement of the multiverse probably not a ruler dependent question. Like these are different measures.
I mean,
the invariants tell you.
Yeah.
That's what the point of the thing is.
Not frame independent, but theory dependent. And I also think that it is really, if you want to wish it, in this case, in my case, I can make sense of a volume measure. By an inflation, you have to end up with what you said. Volume must be discarded, and then you see, and the next best thing has to be discarded too. So it's more like that I can quantify the size of my patches that I'm producing. The volume measure applies. That's what I reach
by. Say volume with respect to what ruler? Volume measure.
Oh, that can
I mean, this is what I also said. You can introduce also next non-uniform coupling to matter, and then you can have probably wide things if you want. I don't exactly know what can happen. Yes.
Is there a difference that makes on three-point functions that might be observable?
So. In the sense that in the Einstein frame, the gravitational part should just look like as inflation in the moment I don't expect anything, because that would, I don't know what should produce it. I mean, my gravitational field part, with respect to curvature perturbations, is constructed to look like the inflation reaction, and I don't have additional couplings. So I don't have higher order kinetic terms in this model or during the smoothing phase. What would produce the equilateral, for example, non-Gaussian FNL, it just produces an inflation because that proportional, usually in single field models, to your equation of state parameter, which is an Einstein frame, smaller than one, and nearly constant. So these are open questions. So the observational signature, I certainly don't claim with a model that just has its first working example that I could say anything about it. But I wouldn't exclude when we better understand what's going on, that there is something. I mean, if you had a full-blown theory later, you ideally want to have something that the other theories don't want to give you. So that I completely agree with. Okay. Thank you.
Thanks.
All right, so again, we're going for speaker lunch right now, and I guess Anna will be here all summer, so if you have questions, you can also ask. Thank you.